We are taking a little break to organize WITS, our Word Theater in the Schools program. So while we are off working, please enjoy our rebroadcasts of our podcasts featuring stories by Joyce Carol Oates. If you're enjoying what you hear here, please send us an email to admin@wordtheater.org. If you're looking for an internship, also please get in touch with us. And always spread the word that the word is Word Theater. Can you imagine what the world would look like if everyone joined us on our mission to make a better world, one story at a time? Welcome to episode 12 of the Word Theater Podcast, your weekly access to the world's finest short stories. My name is Cedaring Fox. I am Word Theater's founder and artistic director.
And I'm Kirsty Peart, UK founder and creative partner. Last week, we began our seven-week celebration of stories by Joyce Carol Oates, performed by really wonderful actors and recorded live with the author in the room.
We hope you will come meet this phenomenal author at the next Word Theater Live Zoom on Sunday, April 18th. We're thrilled to announce that James Cromwell and Tess Harper will be reading one of Joyce Carol Oates' many Pushcart Prize-winning stories, and the author will join the actors in a Q&A after the live performance.
Our live Zooms are free for Word Theater members, so please join us so we can continue bringing you our live podcast.
The story you will hear today is quite startling, and it is read beautifully. To introduce it, please welcome the reader, a longtime friend to Word Theater, Bill Pullman.
I hope you can take some time to settle in and listen to this story. O Sable is a subtly and increasingly tense piece that's so succinctly written that it takes you by surprise. And it deals with a subject that seems to be increasingly more prevalent these days. It's a high-stakes story, and Joyce Carol Oates tells it without passing judgment on the actions of her characters. I think it's deeply moving.
It's early evening, August. In the stillness of the suburban house, the telephone rang. Mitchell hesitated only a moment before lifting the receiver, and here was the first wrong note. The caller was Mitchell's father-in-law, Otto Ben. Not for years had Otto called before the phone rates went down at 11 p.m. Not even when Otto's wife, Teresa, had been hospitalized. The second wrong note, the voice. Mitch, hello, it's me, Otto. Otto's voice was oddly lifted, was eager, as if Otto were a further distance away than usual and worried that Mitchell couldn't hear him. And he sounded affable, even buoyant, as Otto rarely was these days on the phone. Lisbeth, Otto's daughter, had come to dread his calls in the late evening. As soon as you picked up the phone, Otto would launch into one of his riffs, complaint tirades, deadpan, funny, but with a cold fury beneath, and in the long-ago style of Lenny Bruce, whom Otto had admired much in the 50s. Now, in his 80s, Otto had become an angry man, angry about his wife's cancer, angry about his own chronic condition, angry about their Forest Hills neighbors, noisy kids, barking dogs, lawnmowers, leaf blowers, angry about being made to wait 2 hours in a refrigerated room for his most recent MRI. Angry about politicians, including even those he'd helped canvass votes for in the early first heady flush of his retirement from high school teaching 15 years ago. It was old age that Otto was angry about. But who could tell the poor man that? Not his daughter. certainly not his son-in-law. Tonight, though, Otto wasn't angry. In a warmly genial, if slightly forced voice, he queried Mitchell about Mitchell's work, which was corporate architectural design, and about Lisbeth, who was the Baines' only daughter, and about their grown, beautiful, departed children, Otto's grandchildren he'd adored as kids. And this went on for a while, until at last Mitchell said uneasily, "Otto, Lisbeth is out at the mall. She'll be back around 7. Should I have her call you?" Otto laughed loudly. You could all but see the saliva glistening on his full, fleshy lips. "Don't talk to the old man like that, eh? Don't want to talk to the old man?" Mitchell tried to laugh too. "Otto, we've been talking." Otto said more seriously, "Mitch, my friend, I'm glad you picked up. Not Bethy. I can't talk long, and I'd prefer, I guess, to talk to you." Yes, Mitch felt a touch of dread. Never in their 30 years' acquaintance had Otto been called him friend. Teresa must be out of remission again. Dying. And then Otto himself had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease 3 years before. It was not a severe case yet, or was it? Guiltily, Mitchell realized that he and Lisbeth hadn't visited the older couple in almost a year, though they'd lived less than 200 miles away. Lisbeth was dutiful about phoning, usually Sunday nights, hoping, usually futilely, to speak first with her mother, whose telephone manner was weakly cheerful and optimistic. But the last time they talked and they visited, they'd been shocked by Teresa's deterioration. The poor woman had months of chemotherapy and was bone thin. Her skin was like wax. Not long ago, in her 60s, she'd been exuberant, fleshy, sturdy as an earthenware pot. And there was Otto, hovering about, tremors in both hands, his head. He seemed to be exacerbating out of comic spite, complaining brilliantly about medical workers, HMOs, and UFOs in conspiracy. What a strained, exhausting visit. On the drive home, Lisbeth cited lines from an Emily Dickinson poem. "Oh, life begun in fluent blood and consummated dull." "Yeah. Jesus," Mitchell said, dry-mouthed, shivering. "That's it, isn't it?" Now, 10 months later, there was Otto on the phone, speaking matter-of-factly, as if you were discussing selling some property, of a certain decision he and Teresa had come to. Teresa's white cell blood count, his own shitty news, which he wasn't going to discuss. The books were closed permanently on that subject, he said. Mitchell, trying to make sense of this, leaned against the wall, suddenly weak. "This is happening too fast. What the hell is this?" Otto was saying in a lowered voice. "We decided not to tell you and Lisbeth. Her mother was back in Mount Sinai in July. They sent her home. We've made our decision. This isn't to discuss, Mitch, you understand? It's to inform and to ask you to honor our wishes." "Wishes? We've been looking through albums, old photos and things, having a ball of a time, things I haven't seen in 40 years. Teresa keeps saying, wow, we did all this. We lived all that. It's a weird, humbling thing, sort of, to realize we'd been goddamn happy, even when we didn't know it. I didn't have a clue, I got to confess. So many years, looking back, 62 years, the Reese and I have been together, you'd think it would be depressing as hell. But actually, in the right mood, it isn't. Teresa says we've already had about three lives, haven't we? Excuse me, Mitchell said through a roaring of blood in his ears. What is this decision that you've made? Otto said, right, I'm asking you to honor our wishes in this respect, Mitch. I think you understand. What? I wasn't sure whether I should speak with Elizabeth, how she'd react. You know, when your kids first left home for college, she... Otto paused, tactful, ever the gentleman. Never would he speak critically about Elizabeth to Mitchell, though with Elizabeth, he could be blunt and wounding, or had been in the past. And he said now, hesitantly, she can be, well, emotional. On a hunch, Mitch asked where Otto was. Where? Are you in Forest Hills? Otto paused. No, we're not. Where are you then? Otto had an edge of defiance in his voice. At the cabin. The cabin? Oh, Sable? Right. Osable. Otto let that point sink in. They pronounced the name differently. Mitchell Osable, three syllables. Otto Osable, one elided syllable, like the locals pronounced it. Osable meant Ben's property in the Adirondacks, hundreds of miles away, a seven-hour drive, and the final arduous hour along narrow, twisting, mostly unpaved mountain roads north of Osable Forks. So far, as Mitchell knew, the Bens hadn't spent time there in years. If he'd given thought to it, and he had not, for subjects pertaining to Lisbeth's parents were left to Lisbeth to ponder, Mitchell would have advised the Bens to sell the property. Hardly a cabin, but it's a six-bedroom lodge of hand-hewn logs, not winterized, on 12 acres, beautiful, desolate countryside north of Mount Moriah. Mitchell would not have wished Lisbeth to inherit this property, for they wouldn't feel comfortable selling it, something that had meant so much at one time, Teresa and Otto. Yet Osable was too remote for them, impractical. They were people who quickly became restless away from what they called civilization, pavement, newspapers, wine shops, decent tennis courts, friends, and at least the possibility of good restaurants. In Osable, you drive an hour to get to what? Osable Forks. Years ago, of course, when the kids were young, they'd gone each summer to visit Elizabeth's parents, and yeah, it was a fact. The Adirondacks, beautiful. And waking early in the morning, you saw Mount Moriah startlingly close, like a mammoth dream, and the air achingly fresh and pure, piercing your lungs, and even the cries of birds sharper and more defined than you were accustomed to. And there was the conviction, unless it was the wish, that such physical revelation signaled a spiritual condition. But still, Lisbeth and Mitchell were equally restless to leave after a few days of this. They'd take to afternoon naps in their second-story screened-in room surrounded by pines like a vessel afloat in the green tinctured sea. Tender lovemaking and dreamy, drifting conversations of a kind they never had anywhere else.
Still, after a few days, they were eager to leave. Mitchell swallowed hard. He wasn't used to questioning his father-in-law and felt like one of Otto Ben's high school students, intimidated by the man he admired. Otto, wait, are you and Teresa in Au Sable? And Otto said carefully, we are planning to remedy our situation. We have made a decision, and this is to, Otto paused tactfully, this is to inform you. Mitchell felt, for all that Otto was speaking so reasonably, as if the man had kicked him in the stomach. What is this? What is he hearing? This call isn't for me. This is a mistake. Otto was saying that they'd been planning this for years. 3 years, minimum, since his own diagnosis. They'd been stockpiling what was required. Good, potent, reliable barbiturates. Nothing in haste, nothing left to chance, and nothing to regret. You know, Otto said expansively, I'm a man who plans ahead. This was true. You had to concede the point. Mitchell wondered how much had Otto accumulated. Investments in the 1980s, some rental properties on Long Island. Mitchell felt a sinking, sickening sensation that they will leave most of it to us. Who else? He could see Teresa smiling as she'd smiled, planning her lavish Christmas dinners, her monumental Thanksgivings, the presentation of gifts to grandchildren, gorgeously wrapped. Otto was saying, you promise me, Mitchell. I need to trust you. And Mitchell said, look, Otto, stalling, dazed, do we have your number there? And Otto said, answer me, please. And Mitchell heard himself saying, and not knowing what he was saying, of course, you can trust me, Otto, but is your phone connected? And Otto said, annoyed, no, we never needed a phone in the cabin. And Mitchell said, for this had been an old vexation between them from years ago, certainly you need a phone in that cabin. I mean, that's exactly the place that you need a phone. Otto muttered something inaudible, verbal equivalent of a shrug. And Mitchell thought, oh, he's calling from a payphone in Au Sable Forks. He's about to hang up. Quickly, Mitchell said, hey, look, we'll drive up and see you two. Is Teresa all right? Otto said reflexively, Teresa's fine. She's good. And we don't want company. Then, she's resting. She's out on the sleeping porch, and she's all right. Au Sable was her idea. She always loved it. And Mitchell said, groping, but you're so remote, Otto said. That is the idea, Mitchell. Oh, he's going to hang up. He can't hang up. Mitchell is trying to stall, asking how long they've been there. And Otto said, since Sunday, we took 2 days. We did fine. I can still drive. Otto laughed. It was his old anger stirring, his rage. A few years ago, he'd nearly lost his driver's license, and somehow through a doctor friend's intervention, he'd managed to hang on to it, and that was not such a good thing. That could have been a fatal error, but you can't tell Otto Ben that. You can't tell an elderly man he'll have to surrender his car, his freedom. You can't. Mitchell was saying, they'll drive up to visit. I mean, they'll leave at dawn next morning. And Otto was curt in rejecting the idea, saying, we made our decision. It's not to discuss. I'm glad I talked with you. I can see how this would be going with Lisbeth. You prepare her however you think best. Okay, said Mitch. Okay. But Otto, don't do anything. He was breathing fast, confused, not knowing what he said, in a sweat, a sensation like something cold and molten pouring over him too quickly. Will you call back or leave a number? Lisbeth will be home in half an hour. And Otto said, Teresa feels she would rather write to Lisbeth and you. That's her way. She doesn't like the phone anymore. And Mitch said, but at least talk to Lisbeth, Otto. You could say anything, say any subject. And Otto said, I asked you to honor our wishes, Mitchell. You gave me your word. And Mitchell thought, I did? When? What word did I give? What is this? Otto was saying, we left everything in order at our house on my desk. Will, insurance policies, investment files, bank books, keys. Teresa had to nag me to update our wills, but I did. And I'm damn glad. Until you make out a final will, you just aren't facing facts. You're in a dream world. After 80, you are in a dream world, and you have to take care and take control of the way the dream is going. Mitchell was listening, but he'd missed the beat. His thoughts crowded and flashed in his head like playing cards wildly dealt. Otto, right, yes, but maybe we should talk more about this. I mean, you can offer valuable advice. Why don't you wait a while and we'll drive up to see you and we'll leave at dawn tomorrow. Or actually, we'll leave tonight. And Otto interrupted. You would have said rudely if you didn't know the man.
Hey, good night. This call is costing me a fortune. You kids, we love you. Otto hung up the phone.
When Lisbeth came home, there was a wrong, slightly jarring note. Mitchell on the back terrace, in the dusk, alone, just sitting there, with a glass of something. Honey, what's wrong? Just waiting for you. Never did Mitchell sit like this, wait like this. Always his mind was engaged. There was something wrong. But Lisbeth came to him and kissed his cheek lightly. The smell of wine, heated skin, damp hair, what you'd call a clammy sweat, his t-shirt soaked through. Teasing, Lisbeth said, indicating the glass in Mitchell's hand, you've started without me. Isn't this early? And it's strange, too, that Mitchell would have opened this particular bottle of wine, a gift from friends. In fact, it might have been from Lisbeth's parents years ago when Mitchell had been more serious about wine and hadn't had to cut back on his drinking. And Lisbeth asked hesitantly, any calls? No. Nothing? Not a thing. Mitchell felt Lisbeth's relief knowing how she'd anticipated calls from Forest Hills, though, of course, her dad wouldn't usually call until 11 p.m. when the rates went down. Mitchell said, it's been quiet all day. In fact, everyone seems to be away, except us. Their split-level stucco and glass house, which Mitchell had designed, was surrounded by leafy birch trees, evergreens, and oaks. It was a created, not a discovered house. They shaped it to their will. They'd lived here for 27 years. In the course of their long marriage, Mitchell had once or twice been unfaithful to Lisbeth, and Lisbeth may have been unfaithful to him in her intense emotions, if not sexually. But time had passed, and time continued to pass. Like random items in a drawer casually tumbled together, their weeks and months and years in the entrancement of adult life. And this was a peaceful confusion, like a succession of vivid and startling dreams, which after you're awakened, you will be unable to recall except as emotions. The dreams were good, but it's good to be awake. Elizabeth sat on the white wrought iron bench beside Mitchell. They'd have this heavy thing now weather-worn and chipped after its most recent repainting forever. Everyone is away, I think. It's like O'Sable here. O'Sable? Mitchell looked at her quickly. You know, Mom and Dad's old place. Do they still own it? I guess so. I don't know. Elizabeth laughed, leaned against him. I'd be fearful of asking. She took Mitchell's glass from his fingers and sipped from it. Alone here? Us? Alone? I'll drink to that. To Mitchell's surprise, she kissed him on the lips. The first she'd kissed him like that, girlish and bold, full on the lips, in a long time.
We hope you have enjoyed listening to Bill Pullman's reading of O'Sable by Joyce Carol Oates. His reading made the author, and many people who were present in West Hollywood, California when Bill read it live, cry. O'Sable was first published in Harper's Magazine and is collected in Faithless, Tales of Transgression from the Echo Press, HarperCollins Publishers.
We encourage you to visit wordtheatre.com, where you can become an annual member of Word Theatre and be our invited guest on Sunday, April 18th, for our live Zoom with Joyce Carol Oates, James Cromwell, and Tess Harper. You can also pick up a single listener ticket, buy books from our partner, bookshop.org, and sign up for our email list.
Special thanks to Joyce Carol Oates and her entire team for their support of Word Theatre and to the Pushcart Prize, where we find so many of our favorite stories. To Jonathan Sachs, who composed our theme music, and to Joseph Cho, our podcast producer. This is Cedaring Fox in Los Angeles.
And I'm Kirsty Peart in England. Until next week, signing off.